Here we are at our second interview.
Yes, I did just want to make a correction about what I said about Governor Knowles in the National Guard. After thinking about it, I think I probably didn't state what had happened quite correctly. Governor Knowles had talked to me before the Dow and said if we ever had any trouble on the campus that he could always mobilize the National Guard, but he would only do it if I asked him to. I think you have to declare a state of emergency or something of that sort to do it. So on the day of Dow, after the troubles began, he then called and said, I understand there's rioting on the campus and I will send out the National Guard, but you have to ask me to do so. And I said, I'm not asking you to do so. And he seemed quite upset about that.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. And I said, well, if you do it, it's on your own. And then an hour or so later, he called again and said, I understand there's still a lot of trouble up there, and I'm quite willing to send the Guard. I talked to the colonel and so on. And I said, well, I think that a show of military force would be just exactly the wrong thing to do. I think it's squatting down, and that might just throw it into a serious situation. So he said, okay, and that was the end of that. But I think I said earlier in the tape that he had called me several times during the day before.
Mm-hmm.
Implied that it was before the troubles, but that isn't correct. So, I don't know what you
didn't discuss that with Joe Kaufman or Ralph Hansen.
No. Oh, I did with Ralph. I didn't with Joe, but I did with Ralph, mm-hmm. I'm sure. Ralph thought that things were under control, and he was very pleased with the way the county forces that were brought in behaved. Once they didn't come until there was the trouble had started, you mm-hmm. know, until the actual difficulties were underway. And he had been worried about bringing in the county people because he didn't think that they were well enough trained to show restraint. So he used them mainly for directing traffic and things of that sort, but they behaved very well indeed. And there were I don't know how many people, 100 people or maybe more than that who came. And so the students' leaders like Evan Stark had been very much worried that if they came in they'd start beating up everybody, but they behaved really, they weren't faced with the problem that the police were faced.
They didn't actually get in to the
oh no, that was all over. The Bay mm-hmm. building was vacated, but the troubles outside were going on.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, once the news got out, all sorts of people came, you know, there were thousands of people watching the goings on, and so they came and directed traffic, kept people away from this, you know, from getting directly mm-hmm. involved in the action. So there was really no need for the National Guard, and I think perhaps, well, it's hard to know what the governor's motives were, but I'm sure that he didn't want any sort of continuing rioting, as he called it, going on without his stepping in and doing his part. But in any event, that I think is all there was to that. There was no need for the Guard then or at any time after that.
I guess that was an ultimate shock, wasn't it, when the National Guard was finally called in?
Yeah, well, that was never during my days. That was later on, and the Guard behaved, I thought, extremely well once they did come during Ed's periods of trouble, Cambodia Spring and that whole time. I thought the Guard probably behaved better than anybody else we had at any time.
But they were
very well trained. And their colonel was a very intelligent man. He'd had all sorts of riot control training in the Guard, and so it is troops, so they, you know, they behaved very well.
Did you know about a meeting between Harrington and Olson and the head of the National Guard, who was also called Olson, I guess, later on, in the late fall?
You mean that same year?
Yes.
I think I was involved, too. I was there.
Oh.
Yeah.
I read about it in the Carden.
Yeah, I was involved. It was just to tell us what the guard could do and to get us acquainted with the, with whoever the colonel was. I can't remember his name anymore. Who maybe was a general, I've forgotten, but the head of the National Guard. And if we ever need them, what to expect from them, how much notice they'd need, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Nothing like that. There was no immediate threat, anything going on, so mm-hmm. that it was just to kind of get acquainted, and here's a resource that could be used, and so on. Kind of thing. And I think it wasn't in our, we didn't initiate the meeting, I think the governor initiated it, as I recall. He just wanted us to know what was available if we ever had any more troubles.
Well, you have some other things you want to talk
about.
Well,
I was just going to say that the Dow thing, of course, I think we talked last time about the faculty meetings following Dow, and and I was just going to say there were a lot of other things happened during the rest of the year.
I would like to ask you, I went to the Faculty Senate meeting yesterday, mm-hmm. and Irving Shane gave his first mm-hmm. talk, and Anatole Beck had a motion. It was treated rather cavalierly.
By the faculty.
By the faculty, yes.
Yeah, the faculty's just tired of him, you know.
Uh-huh. He was, you mentioned him, I think, last
yes.
time, and he, would you, did he say something rather effective at that point? Somebody,
He said a good deal. I've never known him to say anything that was effective. He says things that are provocative, but he's not a man that I consider to have very good judgment. He's not a man that the faculty trusts, not even the people who are on his side. They just think he's too quixotic and that he is not a particularly good presenter of their point of view, actually. At least that's my impression. At that meeting of the faculty, he spoke several times about police brutality and all sorts of matters of that sort, very emotionally. And of course he did get command a good deal of attention and was one of the main spokesmen, I would say, for a group of students, or for the people who felt the students had been greatly wronged. That's true, but uh-huh. he is not the
he's
sort
not
of
the
person.
Faculty gadfly, then.
He is a faculty gadfly,
but a gadfly,
but not a leader.
Be effective. Shouldn't one thinks of a gadfly as something useful? And you
maybe at times he's been useful, but he isn't the sort of person upon whom faculty, any of the faculty, so far as I know, would place a great deal of confidence as being a man of good judgment. That's why when he speaks on some issue in the faculty, it's almost always defeated. I can't think of anything that he's spoken on that hasn't provoked more opposition votes than if anyone else were to mm-hmm. take
so
that
So he might
position.
Actually harm a cause then.
Oh yeah, that's uh-huh. often true in faculties.
Yeah.
You know, there are some people whom the rest of the faculty just kind of ignore or think of as a nuisance. Sometimes those nuisances are useful. I'm not sure that he isn't. I couldn't imagine, though, a sillier business than the first time the chancellor hasn't even taken office officially and doesn't till the 15th, asking him about a matter that he had nothing to do with.
You were
happened
there, were
two
you?
Or three years ago. No, I read the paper.
Oh.
I wasn't there. Mm. And but that's typical of him, and not being willing to take a reasonable response. It seems to me I would have just said to him, look, I don't know a thing about it. Talk about it, I'll investigate it and talk about it later. And if I feel it's worthy of talking about. And if he pressed me, I'd say, look, I've given you the only sensible answer that a sensible man can expect, and that's the end of it, as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't have been nearly as nice as her was about it. But he is, in my opinion, he's kind of a gadfly. He's fairly irresponsible. He represents very little but himself. He's, from time to time, he becomes the president of the United Faculty, but that's only because they can't get anybody else to do it. You know, the group itself tries to avoid him because he seems to get them into lots of trouble, and he has come to be such a symbol of his position in what many faculty think is kind of the radical left, not necessarily Marxist left, but just kind of radical, irresponsible left, that they can't get people to join their union, and that bothers them, of course. Under more reasonable people, like Bob Alford when he was chairman, their membership grew, but it doesn't apparently under Beck. You know, he's a perfectly nice man, personally, and all that, but I just think he's a rattle brain, and I think a lot of other people think so, too, and that I thought long before I became chancellor. So, I think some people who spoke much more effectively than, many people spoke much more effectively than he did, who were on the side to condemn the actions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he probably heard it more than helped the cause, but that's the role of some people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's some people who are just overkill by nature and or so sure of their own, the righteousness of their own position, that they alienate those who are not nearly so convinced, you know. I mean, he seems to be that sort of a person. So I missed Irv's, I've made the practice not to go to faculty meetings. I've never been willing to serve on the Senate. I just felt that if I were going to stay here, I had to be in a position of never appearing to in any way be speaking publicly for or against the administration. I just wouldn't be comfortable. I wanted to stay here because I've been here all these years and I have a big research program that I immediately returned to, and I could have moved it someplace else, but it would have been inconvenient. I had all sorts of offers, foundation presidencies, even another university presidency, and
you don't want to
say
where.
No. And I just, but it was a Big Ten university. Not an offer. I shouldn't say that, but an inquiry, mm-hmm. if I would be willing. And then, of course, a lot of departments thought that I would be available, departments of sociology. So I got offers from Columbia, from... That was an actual offer. Inquiries from Yale, but they were the kind of inquiries that if I'd said yes the next day, the appointment would have been made, mm-hmm. kind of thing. UCLA, oh, I've forgotten, Minnesota, several places. Figured, you know, this is a good time to get this guy to move. He's probably mad at him, and so. But I wasn't. I mean, I didn't want to move. So I decided that if I did stay here, I had to get out of faculty matters entirely.
So you haven't been on any committees since, you mean?
No, I've been on one committee or two that the deans have had, like I was on the committee to evaluate the school social work.
Oh,
one of these internal investigations, that kind of thing, but I haven't been willing to be on university elected committees or appointed university-wide committees. But why should I? You know, I've been on almost everything there is, and I figured it's time for somebody else to do that kind of work anyway. I would have concluded that by now,
yeah,
in any event. So that, but I did feel that if I stayed here, I certainly could not in any way appear to be second-guessing, confirming or disaffirming anything that the administration did. So that's why I don't go to faculty meetings. Now, I did go once. I broke my rule once when I thought that freedom of inquiry was being threatened by Bill Proxmire, and I certainly went then and I delivered
the
oration
of PhD dissertation subject.
No, it was on the subject of Elaine Walster's research, which he claimed was a great waste of government money and all that sort of thing. And on that occasion, I felt that that was nothing that had anything to do with the administration anyway. That was a faculty matter. And I felt that I could speak to it probably as well as any member of the faculty, because I probably had more experience on NSF and other national committees than anybody in the social sciences. And I felt that it was time to invest a little of my capital and goodwill of my past with the faculty. And as you know, the resolution in my speech was printed in the faculty minutes in its entirety, and the thing with the motion to essentially censure Bill Proxmire passed, of course, with one dissenting vote in the whole faculty. So,
what was the date, approximately, when was that?
About 2 years ago. Well, something like that. I could look it up. I've got the remarks, copies, and all that sort of thing, which you might like to have. Oh, yeah, that was in the newspapers, the Cap Times, scolded Bill and said, look, why should one of the leading scholars at the university, a lifelong Democrat, have to come out and chide you in this way, and isn't it time you started getting on important issues and not just seeking publicity as you have been doing, and so on, you know. And the only honest work, other than being a politician, that the only political job that Bill's ever held in his life, you know, it's literally true, was that for about a year he was a reporter for the Cap Times, and he's always been their darling. While he was establishing residence in the state in order to run, you see, Bill was a resident of Illinois, and he decided during the war and the period just after that, when he was at Harvard Graduate School of Business, to be a politician, and he did it in his usual careful planning sort of way, and he looked around to see where he could go. He decided that and I don't think it mattered much to Bill whether he's Democrat or Republican, he decided that Illinois was no place to run, that the party, both parties were so strongly established there. Where could he make entry into a weak party and take over its leadership? The Wisconsin Democratic Party was certainly that at the close of World War II. We had never elected a Democratic governor, except one man, Loomis, who died before he went into office and was succeeded by the lieutenant governor, who was a Republican. So really, until Gaylord Nelson, there'd never been a Democrat governor of the state. The party was as weak as anything. Bill came in, organized it, got things going, got himself elected to the legislature, then took on old Alex Swiley beat him. No, he took on, he got the Democratic nomination and then took on Alex Swiley and beat him for the Senate and became the successor of Joe McCarthy, and in many ways has behaved, you know, with the same kind of political skills as Joe. he never intended to be involved in this Wisconsin thing, just as Joel McCarthy, you know, never investigated anything in this university, because he knew that cost him votes. And the only way Bill got into this was that he made the mistake of making his award of the month for the Fleece of the Month to Elaine Burscheid, a very prominent psychologist at Minnesota. And some bright young reporter there, when he picked up the story, knew he was the guy who covered the university for the Minneapolis Tribune. He knew that Elaine had been working with our Elaine Walster, and that they'd published books together, and that this was the same project, essentially, even though each of them had their funds and their separate universities. So he just called Bill on the phone and said, look, you've blasted Elaine Burscheid and given her this award, and you haven't said a word about Elaine Walster, who's, if anybody's guilty, is equally so, because she's the co-principal investigator in this research. They've published together everything else, and if you don't do something, then I'm going to have a big story in the Tribune saying, look, here's Joel McCarthy all over again. And, of course, Bill couldn't do anything but blast her. And, of course, had to back it up, you know, with the interviews and everything else. So that's what got him into trouble. I'm sure he never would have done it in the world.
Did he ever get in touch with you in advance of that?
Do
you know? Yes, just to
he never got in touch with anybody in
he
advance.
Didn't.
Oh, he knew that he'd be hurt worse by a prominent paper like the Minneapolis Tribune blasting him for these tactics than he would by anything that, than by carrying through on it here. But I'm sure he knew it was going to cost him a lot of friends and votes. Now, obviously, he ran against a very weak person and won by a landslide. But he's a smart enough politician to know that it's not your friends that keep you in the, that you have to worry about, it's your enemies. And they build up and accumulate over time. And he doesn't like, he also, Bill is essentially an intellectual, and he doesn't like to be alienated from the intellectual community. Can you imagine this? The only other state or U.S. senator from Wisconsin who ever was reprimanded by the University of Wisconsin faculty was Joel McCarthy. So he's, you know, he's
not,
that's a
company
he doesn't like to keep, I'm sure. Whatever he may feel about the faculty. Oh no, Bill never checks anything like that with anybody, I'm sure. But he was too deep in it. What could he do? He was already, you know, he doesn't read this stuff himself. He's got some guy in his office who digs up these things, you see. And if he'd ever read it, he'd know that what he charged about Elaine just wasn't in the project. But he's a cheap publicity-seeking person. I also said over the... They asked me, I was interviewed, you know, but I was hoping they'd put some of the things in the paper that I said, but they didn't. Like, somebody called me from the New York Times and said, do you know Mr. Proxmire? And I said, yes. And he said, do you know him at all? Well, and I said, no. Like, well, yes. We're on at least a first name basis. And he said, well, could you, in a sentence or two, tell me what sort of a person he is? And I said, well, Bill Proxmire is the only man that I've ever known in my life whose friends hate him. And that, you know, I just thought of it like that, and it's true. I don't know anybody that knows him well who doesn't dislike him, and everybody who's worked with him, everybody in the Democratic Party. And then they said, well, you don't seem to have a great deal of respect for him. And I said, well, I've always supported him and voted for him, but I said, when he does something that hurts me and what I stand for, I'll punish him anyway again. That's only language he understands, and that most politicians understand. So anyway, the guy said, well, do you think he's a publicity seeker? And I said, sure. I said, he'd murder his own mother on television if you could give him 5 minutes of prime time.
I can see why they didn't publish it.
Well, you know, it's not libelous, it's an opinion. They should have published it. It would have been fun. And it would have hurt him.
It would have, yes.
And that's why they didn't want to do it, I suppose. Yeah. But anyway, that is the only time that I've ever appeared at a faculty meeting. I would have gone to hear Irv yesterday, but I didn't know he was speaking.
Oh.
So I would have probably listened, gone for a speech and then left.
It was very, very brief.
Yeah, I thought he probably wouldn't say anything. Or talk very long. Well, anyway, I guess that settles that. Well, as I was saying, I think the rest of the year was kind of tension-filled, too. Right after, one of the things I should tell you, because you hit upon this a little. After the Dow incident, even before that, I started feeling that I just didn't have a dependable and sufficient staff at Chancellor's office. There wasn't anybody there that I'd known before, to any extent. And there wasn't anybody I had any great confidence in. What had happened was that Bob Fleming had been a one-man show when he first came and took over. I think he was first provost, and they changed the title to chancellor. Bob is a terribly energetic man, and he likes to, you know, be on top of everything himself. He can delegate, that's no problem. It's just that he had, at least in those days, so much energy that he just wanted to learn the job in every dimension. So he took on two people as assistants to the chancellor, one of whom was Bob Atwell, and the other was Jim Cleary. Mm-hmm. Then when I took over, or when I agreed to take over, he called me in and said, there are two things you must do immediately this day, if you want to take my advice. One, go and ask Emily Peterson, who was his secretary, to stay on as your secretary. You just won't ever find anybody who was any better. And I agreed with that after I'd had her. She was that good. And two, go and tell Bob Atwell that you want him to stay on, because he says he's just a genius at all of the new budgeting procedures, and he was a whiz kid from the McNamara days, and he was chief budget officer for NIMH, so he really knew that side of it. And he said, you'll like him, and he has a very good sense of the university, and he's the kind of person that faculty and deans like to work with, so nail him down, because he can get another job so fast that if there's any doubt in his mind, he'll just go someplace else. And then he said, you better make up your own mind about Kaufman. I think he's competent. He may be a little battle-weary, but he said, if I were staying, I might make him a vice chancellor, but I wouldn't do that until I'd seen how things work out with him. Fred Harrington urged me to make him vice chancellor of student affairs. But I wasn't at all convinced. I wasn't convinced because I thought Joe was just worn out from the struggles of the preceding years. And so I didn't ask him to be vice chancellor. And then he said, Jim Cleary is very competent and very useful, but I don't know whether you'll want to keep him or not. He'd like to go someplace else. He's very ambitious to be a college president or chancellor somewhere. It's obvious he'll never make it here. And he said the one handicap he has is that he's willing to do almost anything you ask him. He'll do it competently, although not brilliantly. And he said, but the problem with Jim is the faculty doesn't accept him. I appointed him as assistant too, and there was no screening committee. Of course, there weren't so many screening committees in those days. And then I was satisfied that he had given good service, so I made him vice chancellor for academic affairs. But the problem is that neither the deans nor the faculty really accept him in that role, in the sense that they're willing to talk to him instead of to you if you're busy. Yeah. Now he's fine at getting up the appointment forms and seeing to it that research gets, applications get channeled in the right direction of getting ready for various rating committees and things like that. He's fine. He works well with the university committee, but he said he's never really been accepted. And he said that's for two reasons. One, he's young. He was relatively a young man at that time, I'm sure, under 40. And two, his scholarly background suspicious because his speech from the speech department. Yeah. And not many people in the faculty are likely to think of speech as a proper place of origin for a vice chancellor unless they happen to be in that physiological and medical kind of aspect, which was then a part of the speech department. But anyhow, that proved to be true. Jim was very cooperative, very nice, very useful for routine and ordinary things, but took no load really off of me. And the load was just unbearable. With the student troubles, with my no longer having any great confidence in Joe to handle things, with the students going over Joe's head all the time anyway, which was Fleming's fault because he'd encouraged that. He was handling those matters himself. So there's no way I could pass it back to Joe. And so I just felt helpless, just overwhelmed by the burden of all the things you had to tend to in that office in times of crisis with very little help. Now, it turned out that Bob Atwell was unusually useful. I valued his counsel on other matters than the business end of the university, but he really ran that. He'd come in and see me every morning and inform me what he'd done the day before, what he's going to have to do. So I'd know, but I just let him do it. That's all there was to it, except for some big, crucial budgetary decisions. And but he was also very useful just he tended to be terribly sympathetic with the students. And I thought it was good to have somebody like that around. But he also knew the faculty quite well. And he was very helpful, but still, his real role kept him busy as administrative vice president or whatever we called
the
business.
He wouldn't have much to do with students, would he?
No, but he did. Because they liked him, he was young, he was liberal, he was, and so they, quite often, whenever there were any building takeovers after that, he always came to my office, and he'd go down and negotiate with them, because they wouldn't talk to Joe, but they'd negotiate with him. And he negotiated them out of buildings, he and Ralph together, you know, in a very friendly way. They'd say, look, you guys, chancellor's willing to let you stay in here if you've made your point, but if you're in here more than 2 or 3 hours, then the regents are going to start raising hell and the governor's going to start raising hell and you only got 100 guys in here and we'll clean you out of here in no time. You better get out. You know, that kind of talk. And they could do it. And they both did it very well. They maneuvered people when they seized the Peterson Hall and various other, 2 or 3 other smaller and abortive kinds of things. So they were very useful. But still I needed somebody whom I knew well and really could trust. Very soon after the Dow.
Could I ask you why you decided to keep Jim Cleveland?
Oh, he was very useful.
That useful enough.
He was useful. Somebody had to be doing the job he was doing. Mm-hmm. He just wasn't able to do what I think a vice chancellor for faculty affairs is, and that is serve as the substitute for the chancellor when he's needed, when the chancellor's busy with other things or gone someplace. Well, anyway, Bert Fisher came over. He's an old friend. I brought Bert here in the department many years ago. We had worked together in the bombing survey in Japan, and I had known him for a long time. I have great respect for Bert. And Bert is very closely in touch with students and faculty, and everybody knew that he was my friend, and so they would come to Bert and tell him their tales, and Bert would come to me and say, look, I thought you think you ought to do the following things. Well, I asked Bert if he would be willing to come in as a vice chancellor and officially serve in that role, because I knew he'd be accepted both by faculty and students, and he said no, but he was willing to give me all the time I wanted, but he thought he could perform a more useful function, not being identified as officially in the administration, and he didn't have any taste for administration.
Do
anyway.
You think he was right?
Yes, he probably was right. He is a supreme and crafty negotiator, and the sort of guy that's always got his ear to, I was going to say both ears to the ground, but he's always got his ear to the ground. He knows what's going on. He knows more people than almost anybody I know of in the faculty. And so he was, and yet he was sympathetic with me. We're old friends, and he would do such things as he would hear of some groups in the faculty who were upset because I was being too lenient with the students, and he'd bring those groups in to talk with me. He'd leave and we'd talk for an hour or so. Or he'd hear of the people in the faculty who were, say, of a more moderate persuasion, who said that nobody was being listened to excepting the radicals and the student friends and the conservatives. So he'd bring in people, groups 15, 10, we'd sit and talk, and I'd hear their views. And likewise with the what was then thought of as the more radical element.
Now there you mean faculty, not
yeah,
students.
Faculty. Mm-hmm. Yeah, faculty. Oh, students. The radical students came to talk anyway. You didn't have to bring them. And the conservative students
yeah.
came to talk. They're the, whatever they are, the Somebody for Freedom group, the Republican ultra-conservative mm-hmm. wing. Those people came. The more radical students came. And the rest of the students, you know, I don't know how you could get them represented. They won't vote in an election. You don't know who they are, even. But anyway, it was mainly faculty that Bert was dealing with, although he knew a good deal about what student opinions were on a variety of topics. So he was very useful. But he came in and worked around the clock for a couple of weeks.
Did he actually have an office up there?
Oh, he'd just come over and sit in an office, yeah, but he didn't see people there. He just.
But, I mean, there was a space.
Oh, yeah.
I was just thinking that if he had been an official vice chancellor, he could have been in on meetings at crucial times that apparently he wasn't in on.
Oh yeah, he was in all the meetings that had to do with planning for how to handle a threatened crisis. With
was
the student.
He even there at the?
Oh yeah, he was in on all those things. Not the Dow. This was post Dow.
Oh, I see.
No, I wish he'd been there.
Yes,
then,
I.
But
I
he
see.
Wasn't. But this is post-Dow.
You hadn't gotten around by that time to asking him to do this, I
yes.
suppose.
Mm-hmm. And then he had been working with me 2 or 3 weeks, and boy, we were just working around the clock trying to put things back together and making strategy decisions. I felt that one of the first things we had to do was to clarify the whole situation about the student discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Procedures, hearings, and all that sort of thing, because that was all messy, you know, and the students complained that they weren't represented in disciplinary proceedings, and yet actions were taken which affected their lives and their careers, and that the system was loaded against them.
Now, was this because policy was unclear or because...
No, policy was perfectly clear.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, the existing rules of the university provided for all sorts of little misdemeanors to be handled by a student court, but anything serious went before a faculty discipline committee. Mm-hmm. And that was in the rules.
Yeah.
And had been for years. Just like any university had those discipline committees in those days.
But were the students unjustified or...
Well, they weren't. They weren't on those hearing committees. That was their point.
I see. Yeah.
Students were not given a chance to sit in judgment in those kinds of cases. Moreover, there was no provision for having an attorney represent you. And there were a lot of things that probably under later in current interpretations, I mean now, would have been seen as being improper by the courts. In fact, there were decisions all over the country around that time, setting aside disciplinary judgments made arbitrarily and without due process and proper hearings. I'm not sure that ours were that bad. I don't think they were, but at least students weren't represented, and there was a lot of question about the whole effectiveness of disciplinary procedures if indeed students weren't represented. Would they pay any attention to the judgments that were made, the decisions that were made? So Bert and I talked at great length about the need to for some reform. So I set up a committee that was chaired by Merman in the law school, and Bert helped me a great deal in picking the people for that and keeping contact with the committee, supplying him with the results of the deliberations on similar matters at Cornell and various other places. And he was really my liaison with that committee. Then we set up the Crow Committee about the same time. Of course, these were, I got them, you know, motions from the faculty to do these, but there were our ideas nonetheless. And then we set up the Crow Committee, which was designed to study the question of whether we should continue to have the same policy about interviews on campus, which only the spring before we had reaffirmed by a huge vote. And again, the vote was not as high, but it was at least 4-1 in favor of continuing interviews, and the Crow Committee sketched out the conditions.
The Crow Committee or the Merman Committee?
The Crow Committee. The Merman Committee was on discipline. Disciplinary procedures. The Crow Committee was on whether or not we should continue to have interviews on campus.
With Hack Fain with Hack Fain and Hugh Richardson.
I don't know.
They were the Merman Committee. Well, that's a...
Well, there were two quite separate reports or copies of them. They were printed in their entirety in the Cardinal.
Yes.
In various other places. In the faculty minutes and so on. But you wouldn't have Merman for whether you had interviews, you'd have him for the legal things, which I'm sure that's right. And Jim was chairman of the other committee. But anyway, he helped me a great deal in setting up those committees and liaison with them and so on. And then, after Bert had been in office, or been helping me for a while, he said, look, the flow of work through this place is just absolutely impossible. The three of us were really handling it. Bob, and Bob Atwell and you and me just can't do it. We're getting behind all the time on the daily business of the university. And you ought to have somebody come in who'd really be vice chancellor and be your executive vice chancellor in a real sense, who serves for you over everybody else when you can't give attention.
The job you wanted him to do.
Yeah.
Which he didn't want.
Which he didn't want to do. And so, we talked about it and agreed that by far the best person that we could possibly talk him into it was Bri Curl, whom we both knew very well, and Bri had been for several years the social science vice dean of the graduate school. And Bob Bach relied on him more than anybody else, and he kind of served as his real executive vice dean whenever he couldn't be there, and turned over a great many matters other than social science matters to them. And we knew that Bri had the energy and that he knew probably more people in the university than any single person in it, and that he was a guy of good judgment and had just the skills we wanted. So I proceeded then to ask Bri to do it, and he didn't want to. And the reason he didn't want to was he didn't want to get involved, as he felt sure he would have to, in the troubles with the students. So the only way I finally talked him into it was to say, okay, we'll leave you out of the student things. I'll try to handle all those that I can with whatever help I can get from Joe, and you can be vice chancellor. You'll deal with deans most of the time. You'll deal with department chairman, you'll deal with faculty, and we'll meet every morning for an hour or so and say what's up and what you're up to and what I've got new that's confronting me, and we'll just parcel out the work and keep each other informed. Well, it was the happiest choice I ever made.
You didn't have to have a search and screen committee.
No. Not in those days. I didn't. I just did it.
Yeah.
I talked to Fred, and he said he thought it was a great idea. Yeah.